You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. Today's podcast is titled Personality, Psychology, and Eating Behavior. Now, this is our first episode in a new series on the psychology of food choice and eating behaviors. Each episode will explore the influence of our personality and psychology and the impact they have on different issues. This week, we'll be looking at what we mean when we talk about the psychology of food choice, and we're going to explore the determinants of our eating behaviors. Now, joining us to discuss it are Professor Jacqueline Blissett, the Professor of Childhood Eating Behavior, co-director of Aston Institute of Health and Neurodevelopment at Aston University. Hello there, Jackie.
Hi there, Stefan.
And we've also got Patrick Fagan, Associate Lecturer in Consumer Behavior, Goldsmiths, and Lecturer in Consumer Psychology at the University of the Arts, London. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Stefan.
So, Jackie, let's just start with you to give us a bit of a framework for this whole discussion. When we talk about eating behaviors, what do we mean?
Well, I guess we can think about eating behaviors as a whole spectrum of human behavior. Often when we're talking about it in a psychological context, people think we must be looking at it as a disorder. So eating disorders or problems at either end of the eating spectrum. But actually, eating behavior, we all do it every day, and we're interested in all kinds of determinants of food choice, food selection, food preference, the amount that you eat, the types of foods you eat. So it's a really complex behavior that, is really key to both our physical health, but also our human interaction.
So we're not just talking about the pathology of eating behavior. We're talking about just how it unfolds.
Absolutely. And most of my research has indeed been focused on just understanding how we develop our eating behavior. And, obviously we're interested in also where this might be going wrong at perhaps both ends of the what we call the food approach and food avoidance scale. But actually, we're also just interested in the fundamental development of eating behavior, how we come to make the food choices we make, how we come to prefer the foods that we prefer, and so on.
Yeah. Now, Patrick, what would you say are the key factors that influences an individual's choice of food? And is there a difference between choice of food and eating behavior?
There's probably a few different factors that influence it. And they can be grouped in terms of environmental. So the kind of nudges that influence what food we eat or don't eat and how much we eat. For example, we'll eat more from bigger plates or eat less from red plates, things like that. But then also on the other side, there's personality factors. So personal factors that influence the kind of food you like and again, how much you eat and how healthy your diet is. But interestingly, these two things can interact as well, so that personality interacts with your environmental nudges. And then, of course, there's an element of upbringing, which influences what kind of food you like. Often, you'll associate food with family, the emotions and certain nostalgic memories. And you might eat food as a comfort to relive those positive emotions. So there's all sorts of things.
And Jackie, in terms of the psychological influences, the base starting point that that guides our eating behaviors, what are the main influences that play a role in determining how we're going to be, how we're going to behave when we eat, or how we eat in the way we do?
So I agree with Patrick entirely that we've got two areas of key influence. So we would call them both intrinsic and extrinsic influences on the determinants of longer term eating behaviour. And right from early, very early in life, we can see individual differences in what we call food approach and food avoidance. So there is enormous difference in people's fundamental appetite. For example, some people are much more motivated by food and much more keen to seek food out and will usually eat greater amounts of it. Other people find food fundamentally less rewarding. And you can see that from infancy. So you'll see that those that basis of appetite and food approach and avoidance manifesting from very, very early in life. We also vary, of course, in our taste preferences, partly as a result of our genetic predispositions. For example, our ability to taste bitter flavors varies according to our genetics. We also vary, Patrick was talking about personality, but we vary right from infancy in temperament. And those temperament differences can influence the types of foods we want to eat and the amount that we want to consume. And in infancy in particular, there's also a very key point, which is about our sensory processing. So some of us are fundamentally more sensitive than others to the external stimuli in our environment. And you can see this, for example, toddlers who you might put on a sandy beach and they immediately recoil their feet. Those are the sensitive kids, and they tend to be the ones who are also fussier eaters.
That's neophobia, presumably.
It's partly neophobia, but it's partly about our sensitivity to external cues. So it certainly feeds into neophobia. Neophobia is a developmental stage that every child goes through. But for those children who are very, very highly sensorily sensitive, that neophobic phase can be really challenging because they will reject any food that doesn't look quite right or taste quite right or feel quite right. So we've got all of these complex internal or intrinsic factors, but then of course they interact with our environment, and that environmental interaction also starts very, very early in life.
Now, I'm fascinated by the whole concept of bitter taste perception. I've done a lot of work playing with PTC strips and not research, just literally playing and testing people. And I tend to find when I do live shows that kids who are very sensitive to PTC tend to be the ones who are most neophobic. Is that one of the real fundamental building blocks of bad nutrition, that oversensitivity to bitterness?
It's not necessarily about bad nutrition per se. So, for example, several studies have shown that you can, for example, through exposure, learn to accept bitter tastes, even if you are bitter sensitive. But it's certainly going to be a barrier to the development of a really wide range of food acceptance if you find a lot of tastes aversive. You know, if you're a small child and you're given Brussels sprouts and they taste really unpleasant, what's in it for you to continue eating them? What's in it for you to diversify to broccoli and cabbage and so on? If you find them less aversive, then you're much more likely to accept them and be willing to have them again. So it's not that you can't overcome bitter taste sensitivity. You can, but it requires a lot more effort than if you don't have bitter taste sensitivity. Yeah.
And if there's anyone who's a little bit confused about what we're talking about here, PTC strips are little tasting strips. They're soaked in a chemical called phenylthiocarbamide. And if you taste it, lots of people have very, very different reactions to it. Lots of people just don't taste it at all. People who have a particular sensitivity to bitterness taste it intensely bitterly, and it's really unpleasant and a lot of fun to watch, especially when you do it with kids. Get your hands on some PTC strips and have a lot of fun with all the family. Now, let's talk about extrinsic effects on consumer behavior. Patrick, I mean, we're talking about media, advertising, peer pressure, COVID-19, economics, education. I mean, it's almost a little bit overwhelming to think about. What's the best way of trying to make sense of the external factors that come to play on eating behavior?
There's two kinds. There's kind of stable ones, or ones that induce stable traits in people. So for example, your upbringing, of course, the culture that you're in is going to prime you to like certain foods. I mean, we tend to like what's familiar. So that kind of culture that you're immersed in will cause you to like certain foods just because you're familiar with it. Mm. But also your upbringing can have an effect on how you deal with emotion. So there's a fantastic book called In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, which is about addiction generally. It talks to the fact that if a child is raised without the proper emotional coping skills or social coping skills, they turn to other outlets for comfort and soothing. Mm-hmm. And of course, food can be one of those, particularly from a, we're talking about kind of biology and genetics. Sugar and I believe salt actually have narcotic effects. So I believe if you give somebody sugar, then they have a higher pain threshold, they feel painless. Or if you put sugar in a baby's mouth, I think it would smile. Am I remembering that right, Jackie? You can probably tell me.
Yeah, you can certainly see the innate facial expressions in very, very young neonatal infants. Their reactions to sweetness will elicit a smile usually. But you can also see reaction very unpleasant faces in response to bitter taste and sour taste too.
Yeah. And then there's kind of the shorter term influences as well. So that might be, for example, you talk about COVID-19 and the media. Stress, of course, will impact our eating habits. So again, we might be seeking that comfort and reassurance, but also stress and confusion cause us to rely on shortcuts. So again, we'll eat what's familiar. We probably won't try new things when things are uncertain. The media and culture also set norms. Of what is accepted or acceptable or popular behavior. So the types of food that everyone else is eating or that people say you should eat, then you're more likely to eat those types of food. And then finally, there's your immediate environment. So these are the things around you while you're making food choices. So for example, how easy is something to reach and to eat? That can influence whether you eat it or not. So there was a study which found that if they put candy and sweets into a different queue in the cafeteria. So if you want to buy sweet things, you have to go into a different queue from the main meals. People ate less of them. So there's all sorts of these kind of environmental nudges. If you play French music, people will drink more French wine. If you play classical music, they'll buy more expensive wine. A whole range of these environmental nudges which influence what we eat and drink.
Patrick, is there a battle going on between companies selling food and people buying them and trying to look after their health?
Yes, absolutely. And it's broader than that, just food as well. There's this kind of battle for people's minds, particularly as behavioral science and data analytics and everything becomes more sophisticated. Yes, there's a battle for people who want to influence behavior, and then the consumers. All of us want to be autonomous and have free will and make our own choices.
I don't want to sort of state the obvious, but who's winning?
I don't know. I think it's a bit of an arms race, you know. This is always evolving.
Yeah, yeah. So, Jackie, now childhood eating behaviour is your area. We have a real problem with childhood obesity in the UK. Obviously, the solutions are manifold and multifaceted and linked in many different ways. What are the things that we really need to be thinking about? Not necessarily just doing, but to be able to analyse and understand the problem, what needs to be done?
Well, we're starting, and many researchers are starting to take a much more systems approach to understanding obesity. And that is to say that we need to be thinking about it not as an issue of an individual's own behaviour, but as the result of a very, very complex interaction between all of the characteristics that we've been talking about that do come within individuals, but in interaction with their environments. And as a result of that, we need to be thinking much more cleverly about the reaction of individuals to their broader environments, and therefore being a bit more complex in the way we think about things like intervention. So many of our interventions that we all start with you know, great intentions, for example, that might just be about educating people about, for example, consuming five fruit and veg a day, don't really take into account the complexity of the understanding of behavior change, and of the role of both the individual and the external environment in eliciting behavior.
Are you saying that wagging fingers at people doesn't change their behavior?
Strangely enough, Stefan, no, it doesn't.
Who knew?
And you know, I mean, whilst some individuals, of course, still will benefit from nutrition education, that isn't really the barrier to behaviour change. There are much more complex barriers out there, because, of course, at the end of the day, the vast majority of us know that what we're supposed to be doing in terms of moving towards more healthy behaviours. But actually, there are enormous barriers there for many people to achieve that. So we just need to be a little bit more sophisticated in our understanding of interventions and what might actually work for groups of vulnerable individuals.
So when I was, I worked as a presenter and writing my own programmes actually for CBBC a few years ago. And we did a couple of series called Gastronuts and one called Incredible Edibles. And lots of people kept on saying to us that you've got to tell kids that they should eat this and they shouldn't eat another thing, and that one thing's bad and one thing's good, and we had a huge amount of pressure to do this. And my view was that the moment we start doing that, the kids will, first of all, they'll switch off the telly and watch something else, but also they'll just hate me for it, because I'll tell them that something that they know is good is bad. And so our view was to make food simply to make food exciting, so that kids would talk about it in the playground. So we were playing with the fascinating science of how these materials work, and making rockets out of lemon juice and bicarb, and just getting food to be part of their world. But is there room for both approaches at the same time?
Well, I think that we need to be led by the science on this, rather than our perception that children just need to do as they're told. And to, you know, yeah. people are very keen to translate food and eating behavior into a set of conditions that require discipline and, you know, authority. And I think that's absolutely the wrong way to go. Focusing on enjoyment of food is really, really key. If you look at the science on what works with improving children's eating behavior, well, first of all, let's look at the science that shows problematic eating behavior. If you restrict children's food, it's usually we're restricting the high fat, high sugar, really palatable, delicious types of food, then what happens, we can show this experimentally, is that they fundamentally become more attractive to children. If you pressure them to consume a food, so if you say you must eat all of the vegetable X on your plate, then they actually eat less of that vegetable in the future, and much less willing to try it again in the future. So
it's counterintuitive, though, isn't it? Because we've grown up being told things rather than being encouraged.
Absolutely, it is counterintuitive, so it's a demonstration that this authoritarian approach to developing food preferences just doesn't work. But what we know works is exposure. If you expose kids to a wide variety of fruits and veg, they are much more likely to accept them. And that exposure certainly doesn't mean force feeding. It means playing with the lemon, creating that rocket in the playground. You know, it can be something as simple as getting kids involved in chopping up the carrots in the kitchen. That we know that exposure element works really well. We also know that making using small rewards like stickers for trying new foods can be really beneficial, but certainly not rewarding the consumption of your broccoli with an ice cream. So there's lots of stuff we know about what works. We just need to find ways of making that accessible to children right across society.
There's a huge amount of research on what's called reactance theory. So it's kind of colloquially known as reverse psychology. But if you try and force people to do something, often they'll do the opposite just to feel that they have some autonomy. And there's some research, for example, that this might be preventing people from environmentalism. It may also be part of the reason why teenagers start smoking in the first place, is because they're told that they can't. But I like to think of the alternative as a bit like the movie Inception. If you can make people feel that it's their idea, so through this kind of subtle, nuanced exposure, for example, then that's more effective than just trying to tell them in an authoritarian way to do it.
Yeah. Now, obviously, there are. It's very easy to demonize food companies. They are obviously making a profit and employing people, and they're supplying food, which we need to eat. But there are also lots of food companies who are supplying, you know, healthy food. Obviously, health and diet is a very complex connection. But would you say there is a sort of a battle going on? I know I've used this phrase already, but between companies who are trying to help people eat a better diet, and companies that are trying to cling on by their fingertips to relatively cheaply available commodities like sugar and fat, and hawk chocolate and sweets and other things that, you know, I know there are lots of other complex foods that are not necessarily good for you in a diet. But is this tension good, or can it be used to help the public's health across the board?
I think it's difficult. I mean, when we look at all of the interventions, quite life-changing interventions that have been introduced for coronavirus, and then you see that, well, actually the biggest killer is still heart disease, I think. It kind of makes, you know, fast food indefensible, and why aren't we doing more about it? Does it really have any societal benefits? You know, a brand that is just essentially fizzy sugar water. But then on the other hand, there's always, when you're doing interventions for the public good, for the public health, there's a concern that you might get things wrong, even if you have the best intentions. Mm. So an example that I really like to talk about is during the British Empire in India, there were too many snakes in Delhi. So they introduced this thing where if you brought in a dead snake, you got some money. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to be going well. People were bringing in loads of dead snakes and numbers seemed to be going down. So they stopped the scheme. But what happened was the residents were actually breeding snakes to take advantage of this and get money. And so when the scheme stopped, they just let them all loose in the city.
Oh my gosh.
So they had the best of intentions with this scheme, but, you know, life is chaotic and complicated, and human nature as well. Mm. It's hard to put into boxes. So it's difficult. I think probably the best thing to do is to let nature and life take its course. Life will find a way, and trust that people ultimately are smart enough to make rational, conscious decisions in their best interest.
Mm. But when you have external pressures like advertising media and things like that warping the way that works, I guess it's complicated, isn't it? Jackie, let's just roll back really to the beginning of life. Do food preferences start in the womb?
Well, there's a small amount of evidence in human studies, at least, that suggests that, yes, indeed, we might be starting to develop our flavour preferences in utero. So there have been a couple of studies, and in fact, I have a PhD student just looking at this exact question at the moment, looking to see the degree to which the flavours within the mother's diet might transfer to the amniotic fluid. And of course, the fetus effectively breathes in the amniotic fluid and swallows the amniotic fluid. So you can get that exposure to certain flavours, certainly things like garlic, we know transmits through to the amniotic fluid. We think carrot flavour transmits. And we have some early evidence that suggests that maybe the flavour of green vegetables might even be transmitting through. So it's certainly possible that exposure can be occurring through pregnancy. And it also, of course, importantly, can occur through exposure to flavour through breast milk. So that's one of the reasons why breastfeeding is thought to facilitate acceptance of a wider variety of foods than formula milk.
Now, just this is one thing that I've always got a little bit stuck with, really, because obviously we eat food, we metabolize it, we break it down, and we, you know, there's anabolism and catabolism, and we break it down and build new things. How do the sort of core compounds of something like garlic still make its way through all those different barriers and enzymes and acids and bile and all and remain intact? How does that work?
Well, I think you're going to need a biologist rather than an anthropologist to precisely answer that. But for example, you can see it yourself in terms of garlic. You know, when you consume garlic, you may, if you've consumed enough of it, at least you may also be able to smell it, for example, on your skin. So the aromatics that are part of the flavor of garlic can pass through our systems in a way that we think might still elicit that same flavor experience or a similar flavor experience.
And there's always asparagus wee as well too.
Exactly. So things like this, yes, we know despite our body's best efforts to metabolize things, that process can certainly occur. It may not occur for all flavors, of course, but certainly for some of them.
Yeah. And when we look at consumer behavior and the very youngest children and babies, Patrick, what are the factors that begin to change the behavior? Because the consumer there is the parent, but presumably they are in control of the child's behavior and affect in some way. How does that work?
Well, not always. Don't underestimate the power of pest of power. Mm-hmm. And there's still nudges and advertising and so on aimed at children. I mean, there's a study where they looked at the mascots on the front of cereal boxes, and they found that children's mascots, they looked at the gaze where the eyes were looking if you had the box on the supermarket shelf, and the children's cereals mascots were looking at about child height, and the adult mascots were looking about adult height. So those boxes were still designed to grab the attention and attract children.
Cheeky buggers.
Yeah.
For the youngest children, when parents are choosing food in the supermarket, they are obviously affected by lots of extrinsic factors. But does their choice then translate into behavioural sort of a set of behaviours for the child?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with diet, it's a bit like if you hang around in a barber's long enough, you'll get your hair cut, and so the food you buy in the store or exposed to in the store, it will eventually set up these chains of behavior that will influence your diet throughout the week, depending on what you buy during the shopping trip.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, we've all been in lockdown here. I've had my kids here in the house. Food becomes a tool in a way. My kids are teenagers, so they're pretty much in control of their own lives, to be honest, except I put the food in the fridge. But a lot of parents, you know, will have to feed their children every single meal and use food as a tool, you know, maybe to deal with boredom, maybe as rewards. Are these dangerous things to implement, Jackie?
Dangerous is probably a strong word to use, but it's certainly the case that our work has shown that, for example, parents who use food as a reward with their very young children, their children are much more likely to show emotional eating under conditions of negative mood a couple of years later. So it's certainly the case that where we're using food for anything that's not about nutrition or satisfying hunger, that comes with an element of risk, because we're effectively teaching our children that we can use food in different ways. And of course, many of us do that. Many of us will turn to food, in times of stress and use it as a source of comfort. But that's not necessarily the most healthy way of approaching eating behavior. So we know, for example, that people who have greater tendency towards emotional eating are also more likely to have obesity or to develop overweight. So it's not dangerous per se, it's just probably not a great habit to get into. You don't need to ban less healthy food from the house completely, but try not to use it as a reward or try not to use it as a comfort.
Are there, and this is a question for both of you really, are there any sort of real simple tools, sort of surprisingly simple solutions? So the only thing that springs to mind for me is, you know, we used to eat a lot of biscuits in the house, and then I stopped buying biscuits. We stopped eating biscuits in the house. And the phenomenal amount of sugar and fat in biscuits, and that was just completely taken out of our diet. A friend of mine stopped. He was pretty fat. He said, "Do you know, one day I realized that you don't have to eat until you can't eat anymore." And that absolutely changed his life. are there things that we're just missing? Simple solutions that will help everybody?
I think the healthy food environment, as far as possible, is key. And if we're talking about the home food environment, you know, what's accessible and what's available in the home food environment to children is what parents bring into the home, typically, certainly in the very early years of life. Mm. So the fundamental advice is, if you don't want your children to eat it, don't bring it into the house. And if you do want your children to eat it, then bring it into the house. Mm. And those are, you know, that's really simple. But even that kind of advice is actually harder to follow than you might think. You know, if you're somebody who likes the occasional biscuit, then, you know, are you going to never have biscuits in the house again? But we do know that having those kinds of general guides, so, you know, if you're going to bring biscuits into the house, then, for example, don't overtly restrict them from your children. So
yes,
biscuits once a week, and, you know, everybody, you know, have as many biscuits as you like, and then they're all gone, and then we don't have any more. And having those kinds of rules, so trying not to use that kind of food as a tool, food as reward, or withholding food from children if you think they've been naughty, all of those kinds of sort of conflating food with discipline or with good or bad behavior is best avoided.
And Patrick, any low-hanging fruit from you?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, physical and mental availability are probably the biggest drivers of consumption here. So having the food in the house, you'll eat it. But there's even research showing that if some chocolates are put into an opaque bowl with an opaque lid, then people ate fewer of them than if the bowl was transparent. Or if the bowl was on a desk 6 feet away, people ate less.
Brilliant.
The more effort you have to put into something, the less likely you are to do it, because we're cognitive misers with very limited brain power, limited physical effort, limited time. So availability is one thing, and also mental availability. So in other words, out of sight, out of mind. Put it in the cupboard rather than having it on the kitchen worktop. Try not to watch the TV while you're eating, because it distracts your cognitive mind and you may not notice those messages that you're full. And also try not to drink while you're eating, for the same reason. Mm-hmm. And along those same lines as well, if you can limit stress in other ways, because food is a great source of comfort. So if you can find other ways to limit stress or relieve boredom, then you might not turn to food instead. So mindfulness is great.
And do you think these different, I call them tricks, but they're not. I mean, it's a fact. Do you think that a combination of those is enough to fundamentally change somebody's diet to make them healthier?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Nudge Unit, the Behavioral Insights team, call this radical incrementalism. Mm-hmm. So it's just it's like compound interest, you know, with money. It's these tiny, tiny changes. They don't seem like they make a big difference, but actually over time, cumulatively, they do. And there's a good book as well. I think it's called The Power of Tiny Habits. So it can be quite daunting to think to change your entire diet and to stop eating burgers and fries or whatever it might be. But if you can just commit to very small changes, then over time they'll make a huge difference.
Yeah. Now, we've been in lockdown. Now, this has fundamentally changed something else, which is our lifestyle. We don't go out as much. People don't go to the shops as much, although they still are going out there. I mean, a lot of delivery services have expanded. Has the fact that people are choosing their food from maybe their laptop or computer at home changed their food choices? And has it changed consumer behavior simply because of the environment within which we make those choices about what food is going to enter the front door?
Well, I do know that when people shop online, they feel less self-conscious. So when they're not kind of around other people, being watched by other people, they'll make more hedonic choices, more impulsive choices. So they probably do buy less healthy food, yes.
Really? I was thinking that the opposite might be true. Jackie, what have you found?
Well, we haven't done any research on this. I think that it could have some benefits and some downsides. I mean, if you're shopping or ordering takeout, you're still creating your own food environment in your own home, aren't you? We might be exposed to fewer opportunities to purchase that food, but we're still exposed to food advertising, etc. I think there is a little bit of research coming out on what's happening with parents and their feeding of their children through lockdown, and there has, for example, been a slight increase in the frequency with which parents are eating with their children, as an obvious benefit of not having a long commute, for example, and also of preparing more home cooked foods. So it's possible that there are some benefits as well as some downsides.
You're hedging your bets there, though, aren't you? Now, what about personality types? How much does personality type influence food choice? Is it another fundamental building block of how we eat?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a few personality traits which influence diet choices. Perhaps the most important is openness to experience, which is about how tolerant you are of ambiguity, how adventurous and socially liberal you are. So people who are open to new things will, as you can imagine, have a more varied diet, but they also tend to be a bit more philosophical. It's not that they're more intelligent, but they just like to think more and read more. They're more curious. Mm-hmm. So they probably are better educated on what's a good diet or not. Conscientiousness is important as well. So that's kind of following the rules and being reliable, dependable. As you can imagine, they have good diets. They tend to live significantly longer. They eat less unhealthy food and do less binge drinking and so on. Then another two traits which are also interesting, but from a more emotional side. One is extroversion, which is about being sensation seeking and liking to experience excitement, really. You need to have external stimulation to kind of be working at your optimal level. So these kind of people, they like to listen to music or have the TV on in the background while they're working because it helps them concentrate. Whereas an introvert tends to need silence to be able to concentrate. But extroverts, yeah, for that reason, they like really kind of exciting food, spicy food, high fat, high sugar food, and so on. So that can be a bit of a flag if you're an extrovert. They also tend to drink quite a lot, relatively speaking. But then the other emotional side is neuroticism, which is tending to be sensitive to threats and danger. So tending to be a little bit more blue in your mood sometimes, maybe a little bit quicker to be irritable. And these types of people tend to eat for comfort reasons, to seek reassurance and to be soothed and to escape from their stressful thoughts or environment. And so as you can imagine, they tend to do more emotional eating and eat more comforting food with more sugar, more fats and so on.
And with every word of that little piece that you said there, Jackie and I were both trying to pick and choose which of those we were, which is quite fair enough. Now, presumably we are locked into our personality type. I mean, there is a genetic predisposition to certain things, and then there's willpower. What's going to win out? I mean, you know, are we locked into bad diets, do you think?
Well, do we have free will? I mean, that's a big question. So there is some research suggesting you can maybe change your personality. And certainly personalities do change as people age. They, on average, become more organized and more agreeable and trusting and a bit more conservative with a small c. But also there is some research suggesting that, yes, if you do try and apply yourself, you can change your personality, because your personality is really just consistent behaviors. So if you change what behaviors you're doing over time, you will therefore change your personality. Mm-hmm. It is genetic, but it's also environmental. And a big meta-analysis of twin studies found that it's about 50-50 actually, genes and environment. So there is some hope there. So the other side of that, however, is that certain personality types are more likely to try and change their personality and to have the willpower and the get up and go to do it in the first place. So if you're conscientious, you tend to have pretty good life outcomes across the board because you apply yourself and you have that persistence that's required for success.
So Jackie, if we can identify people's personality type, can we deploy a little bit of pre-crime into our understanding of whether or not children are going to be eating healthily or not? Is genetics really important to understand?
Yep.
You know, how a child is going to develop right from the start of its life.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's really a very important determinant. As Patrick was saying, it's not all about genes or all about environment. It's about that interaction. But we can see very early those children who either have a predisposition towards, for example, high levels of food approach behavior or higher levels of appetite, but also those children with those temperamental traits that then may map on to those personality characteristics later in life. So, for example, children who are more difficult to regulate in terms of emotion, so babies who cry a lot, for example, also often don't sleep very well, but they're also often more difficult to feed. So that general sort of dysregulation tends to predict greater fussy eating. And more adventurous children tend to approach new food more easily. So you can see that they're likely to have a broader range of foods in their diet. But of course, what foods they're exposed to depends on their environment. So you could have a child who is actually very adventurous in terms of their fundamental traits, but who doesn't, for one reason or another, have a wide access to a variety of foods. And so the outcomes for those children will be very different. I mean, we've even shown in one of our studies that babies who are perceived to smile and laugh more by their parents. So that's one of the characteristics of greater sociability that we see very, very early in life, actually tend to be introduced to solid food earlier. And we know that introducing babies to solid food earlier tends to also be associated with greater risk of the development of overweight. And we see these traits are starting very, very early in terms of not just how they react to their environment, but also eliciting different environments for themselves. So it's a complex developmental exchange between the infant's characteristics and their environment.
Yeah. Now, we really should work to wind things up now. We've been talking for far too long because I'm absolutely fascinated by the subject. So I'm going to take ourselves away from the complexity that you've talked about and demean everyone by saying, can you just give us the one trick? You may have mentioned it already. What's the one trick associated with the psychology of food choices that you think has a surprisingly good effect on helping people to eat better? Patrick, what do you think is the one little trick that we should use?
I will go with availability and say out of sight, out of mind. So whatever food you buy for the week, that's the food that you'll eat. And if you can see it and reach it easily, then you'll eat it.
Yeah, maybe I should get a ladder up to the cupboard and then I can get biscuits back in the house. And Jackie, one little sort of psychology of food choice trick that you recommend for us.
Yeah, so I would normally agree with Patrick, but as he's done the accessibility and availability one, I'm going to go from a parent's perspective of modelling. So modelling healthy eating yourself. If you want your kids to eat well, then you need to do it yourself. And that's so frequently overlooked by us as parents. And I think that there's so much evidence out there that suggests that, you know, if your children see you eating healthily yourself, then they're much, much more likely to do it themselves. They might not do it at that time, but certainly may do it in the future.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I think those are both brilliant ideas. Patrick and Jackie, thank you so much for joining us today. Absolutely fascinating. I love this subject. And I hope that we're going to revisit it in the very near future as well. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Patrick Fagan and Jackie Blissett. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from gut health to food security. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Tabletop Podcast, brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.